This year is AD 2008, and the AD is an abbreviation for the Latin words Anno Domini, which means the year of our Lord. It is to say that every time we write a letter, sign a check, send an email, or tell someone what year we were born, we are counting up from the birth of Jesus Christ. So the calendar is centered upon his birth in Bethlehem. And I fully understand that, and I celebrate that, although there is a sense in which I kind of wish that the calendar were 33 years different. That would make this year 1975. And it would begin not with the birth of Jesus, as important and wonderful as that is, but with the events of Holy Week that begins today, beginning with Palm Sunday and including Maundy Thursday, the marking of the beginning of communion at the Last Supper, and Good Friday, good for us, not for Jesus, good for us, and Sunday, a week, Easter, that the calendars center on these supernatural, astonishing, amazing events, including the death of Jesus and his resurrection back to life again. Good Friday, it was an awful day for Jesus. He was tried, he was declared to be innocent, and he was condemned to die. He was whipped almost to death, and then they led him away to crucifixion. In Matthew 27, the historian tells us that as they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come on down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani?" Which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. As evening approached, there was a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. Jesus had not slept the night before, the Thursday of Crucifixion Eve. He had spent it in large part in the Garden of Gethsemane. And it was there that the full realization and the full weight of taking on the sin of humanity poured all over him until he pleaded that he escape from it. And he almost died from the depression of taking on human iniquity. He had trials through the night, and early on Friday morning, he was whipped almost to death. All this before 9 o'clock in the morning. And somewhere shortly before nine, the soldiers prodded him on to his crucifixion. Typically, in those days, what they would do would be to wend their way through the city streets, taking the longest route they could to the place of crucifixion so that lots of people could see him. And the crimes of the one to be crucified were written on a placard, usually hung around his neck, but sometimes carried by the soldier who preceded the person to be crucified. And then that sign was nailed to the cross so that the crimes that had been committed were announced to everyone and it was considered to be something of a deterrent. But early in this path to the cross, Jesus collapsed when the cross was placed on him. It was simply too much for him to carry. He was too tired and too weak and had lost too much blood. Perhaps usually they would poke him and prod him with a spear or beat him with the whip, but the soldiers knew that prodding or whipping this man would do no good. He was simply too weak to be able to carry on. And so they conscripted a tourist who was there, a man named Simon from North Africa, probably a pilgrim who had saved up all of his life in order to come to the holy city and never dreamed that he would end up carrying a cross. In those days, the Romans said that if they had their army occupying a country, they could force anyone at any time to become virtually a temporary slave. All they had to do was take a spear and use it to tap anybody they pleased on the shoulder. And that day, they tapped on the shoulder of Simon. The death march went through the city and finally outside the gate to a place called Golgotha. It was a word that meant the place of the skull, because apparently the topography of the area looked like a human skull. And I shudder to think about what they did next. They put the cross down on the ground. They forced Jesus to lie down on the wood, the rough timber with its splinters poking into his raw back. The soldiers experienced an execution, bent his arms because that was necessary for crucifixion to work the way it was supposed to. They felt for the soft spot at the base of his wrist, placed the nail there, and then brought out the hammer and drove first one and then the other nails through his wrists, his hands, and then bent his knees and nailed his feet to the cross, and then lifted up the cross and dropped it into a socket in the ground. And you try to imagine the pain. You know, capital punishment in the 21st century is supposed to be humane and brief and painless. The Romans had exactly the opposite view. It was to be inhumane and last as long as possible and be excruciatingly painful. Imagine being hung on a cross like a picture on a wall, writhing in pain for hour after hour, fighting to get a breath and bleeding. There was a group of women in those days who banded together on a regular basis, wealthy women who contributed their own money to purchase the ingredients and mix together a wine that was spiked with drugs. And they would go whenever someone was crucified, and they would offer a drink of this narcotic, hoping that somehow it would take the edge off the pain of crucifixion. And so they were there that day, and they offered this drink to Jesus, but he refused it. He was going to take the full agony of the cross, and he was going to take it full force. And then there were those nearby who mocked and insulted him. The soldiers who divided up his clothes. They figured he wouldn't need them because he was soon about to die. And that was considered to be one of the perks of being an executioner. You would get the victim's belongings. And then there were those who just walked by because they were on their way to work or to the market. It was along a busy road, probably a cross that was short enough that you could look the victims right in the eye and you could have a conversation with them while they were being executed. And those who came by repeatedly insulted him. They took teachings that they knew that he had given about raising up the temple and about being the Son of God. And they picked those things and said, come on, if all of that is true, then why don't you just get down off the cross? And the religious leaders came and they did the same thing, sort of with a theological twist to what they had to say. Even the criminals who were being crucified on either side of them, in their own pain and misery, writhing, trying to gasp for breath, they joined in with the crowd. They heard what everybody else was saying, and they threw their comments in as well to pile up the insults and the humiliation. And Jesus never defended himself, nor did God defend him. God remained silent. God did not intervene. He did not get him off that cross. Maybe in some very small ways, you have experienced a little bit of what Jesus experienced there that day. Maybe you have had folk who have said to you, this God that you believe in, if he's really the God that you say he is, then why doesn't he get you the job that you want? Why doesn't he get you out of the mess that you're in? If God is God, why does he let a child die? Why does he let poor people suffer? Why does he let tornadoes and hurricanes sear across whole communities and cause devastation? Why doesn't your God, who is supposed to be so powerful, exercise his power and stop what is going on? And God is silent. And he doesn't answer the provocations and the questions. He did not speak a word in Jesus' defense. The first nail was driven about 9 a.m. Jesus did not die until 3 p.m. So that was 6 hours on the cross compared to other crucifixions. It was relatively short, but it was a time of indescribable pain and indescribable loneliness. Like you, I have wondered what it will be like when I die. For no matter who we are, no matter how young or old or what our station in life, we know that that is the universal human experience. So I have wondered, will I die quickly or will my death be prolonged? Will it be from an accident or will it be from a disease? Will it be painful or will it be relatively comfortable? And then there is one thing that I've thought about maybe more than any of those others in speculating about my own death to come. And that is whether it is long or short, whether it is painful or comparatively easy. I don't want to be alone. I just don't want to die by myself. I would like to have around my bed when it is my time to die those whom I most love and those who love me. Perhaps the most awful moment of Jesus' crucifixion came when, hanging on the cross, he cried out in his native Aramaic, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which in English is, my God, why have you forsaken me? It was the loneliness of dying in all of this without even God, his Father, there by his side. So, did God abandon Jesus on the cross? Did he forsake him? You know, I don't think he did. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. In those hours and in those moments, human sin was somehow concentrated and put on Jesus. He was drenched in it. It was inside and it was outside and all over him. He who had never sinned, who was innocent and perfect, sin completely concentrated onto him. That is, every sin of everyone in every time, every lust, every murder, every theft, every lie, every profanity, every rape, every racist remark, every mistreatment of the poor, all of those things concentrated together on Jesus. Jesus, who had never sinned, was made to be sin for us. And that had to be the most difficult moment in the relationship of the eternal triune God. They who had been together since before time began and all of eternity past, and God the Father had such disdain for sin that he could not look at his own son. And Jesus felt abandoned in all of this, forsaken. It was so deep, so profound, that in desperation, he cried out, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" In the smallest of comparisons, we have sometimes tasted a little bit of this. We have been in those situations or circumstances where we were so discouraged, so overwhelmed, so depressed, that we became convinced that God was not there. That God, if there is a God, somehow was busy running the universe or somehow found our circumstances so distasteful. And we felt desperately alone and hopeless. And so we too have asked God, "Why have you abandoned me? Why have you given up on me?" But God never gave up on Jesus. And God never abandoned him. And God never gives up on us or abandons us, even if we are convinced that he has. When Matthew reported all of this, and especially the moment of the death of Jesus, he did not sensationalize or emotionalize. He simply said that when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. We have to go to another biographer. We go to the words of John to find out what Jesus actually cried out the last time. John tells us that what Jesus said was, "It is finished." And then John adds that he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Amazing, because that is to say that in the final last moment, it was Jesus who volunteered to die. So in spite of all that we say about all those who have conspired and acted against him, in the final act and moment, he was the one who gave up his life as a sacrifice for human sin. When Jesus cried out, "Why have you forsaken me?" it was with desperation in his voice, but I think a totally different tone of voice when he shouted, "It is finished." This was more like the marathon runner who has come the distance, is exhausted, ready to collapse, but crosses the finish line, breaks the tape, and says, "It's finished. I made it. I did everything I was supposed to do. I completed the race. It's over. I've won. It is finished." Jesus came to save his people from their sins. He came to seek and save those who were lost. He came to be the Lamb of God to take away the sins of the world. This was his whole destiny, his whole purpose. And so triumphantly, victoriously, in his last words, he shouts it out, "It is finished." And at that moment, everything changed forever. It was a supernatural moment unlike anything that was ever before. The earth quaked. The curtain in the temple that stood between the Holy of Holies, the resident place of God in the temple, and everyone else, no one could go there except the high priest one day of the year. It split at the moment Jesus died, just ripped from top to bottom. There were people who came out of their graves in one of the most stunning aspects of the story, something that had never happened before and has never happened like it since. It was miracle upon miracle. It was everything upset and turned upside down until even the veteran executioner, the Roman centurion, with the earth shaking under his feet, admits it. Surely this was the Son of God. And it was over. Or so they thought. Unable to imagine anything bigger or better or more amazing, hardly anticipating what would come 3 days after. The family and friends of Jesus were responsible for his burial. But Jesus' family, they were poor, and they were a long way from home in Galilee. And yet they were, under the law, required to see to it that the body was buried before sunset. It was already now after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so a very rich man from the village of Arimathea stepped up, and he had purchased a tomb, a piece of rock that had had a tomb hewn out of it for his own burial. And he went to Pilate and he asked permission to take Jesus' body and to have it buried quickly because there was such limited time in this grave. One of the amazing ironies is that Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Sanhedrin, and it was the Sanhedrin that had initiated the charges that brought Jesus' execution. And yet he was a disciple of Jesus, one probably not invited to the late night deliberations of the Sanhedrin, one who was a follower of Jesus, even though he was in the midst of those who were so much against Jesus. So Jesus' body was buried. And that's what happened the day that Christ died for you and for me. We've visited the crucifixion of Jesus today. We have stood where the women and the soldiers stood. We've watched and we've listened for Jesus to die. And now I invite you to just take one more look. Before we go, to just look back at what happened. I invite you to read again in silence the words of the story of the day that Jesus died on the cross.